Hello, in this podcast I want to discuss the thorny topic of what we should be teaching in science. I'm a scientist and have been a science teacher. The two worlds don't quite fit together, and this is my podcast of Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. So yeah, indeed I am a scientist. I've sort of looked at some big problems in quantum mechanics, new molecules, lasers, optical fibres, robotics, even into gravity waves. So I've had a good innings and exposure to science and the science community. And to my surprise, there's a general sort of assumption that scientists cannot teach science. And so we take a step backwards, and try and work out what's going on. First, a few words about science. One of the things you could say about human science, is that humans as an animal value solutions. So we value people who can find solutions, and we sort of recognise the value of people finding solutions. So this is true in the animal kingdom. You can have a group of animals find a solution, and it will be communicated amongst those animals. There's a story of birds in Britain where one bird found out a way to actually peck its way through the foil cap of milk, of the old milk bottles, and pretty soon that actual methodology, that valuable solution, it was communicated through that bird population. But in the human condition, we value solutions, and so we are always looking, or can always look at how other people do things. We pass on solutions, we value solutions, we pass them on to our kids. So the kid is there and has a variety of health, social connections, and also sort of know-how. So we tend to put it across. And in general, we've sort of developed science as a repository of know-how. So it is actually a solution offering, and it's a communal activity which we have contributed to over millennia, that we've slowly put our wisdom together in a central position, and we've integrated into our life, so it becomes quite valuable. So when you really come to think of it, we rely on science. We put our trust in science. When we board an aircraft, it flies. We really require people to do their calculations, for the pilot to know that there's a certain amount of fuel involved inside. The fuel's a certain quality. There's science all the way through there. And in the legal system, we require science to determine how fast we are going in the car. And at the end of the day, when we decide to lock someone up for doing a crime, we rely on science to prove it. So science itself has got to be, it's because it's involved in justice and the way that we think in commerce. It's got to have a universal access, and it's also got to have quality systems coming into it, and review and judgment for all. So it's got to be something that everyone has access to, and that we can work together. So science itself is a construct, an abstract construct, which we have all access to, and we in theory can get up to it and learn our way or understand our way across to any concept, and so we can rely on it as a social process. So it's a group of solution offerings. It's a group of models that we put those solution offerings together. There's a group of stories in it. There's narratives and stories. It's a whole sort of like a toolkit, solution toolkit that we can and do use. We use it in commerce, justice, technology, life. Our life expectancy has extended. So a lot of our life, say a third of our life expectancy or half our life, we can actually relate back to science. We can control our social interactions by educating women. Our birth rate is down. The actual structure of our society is really based on this science toolkit, and it's a science toolkit which is not based on someone else's authority. It's an open, accessible toolkit which sits over the top of our complex society. And so our society can come and go, but the science will still stay there, and we still have access of it. So we can have access to society, to science developed by the Soviet Union, by the Germans of World War II. They still developed science, but we still have access to that knowledge and understanding which has come, and we've built on top of it. So science, when you come to think of it, yes, it is an explanation of nature, but it is an overall got other aspects to it, and that's quality control, accessibility, and a sort of a candor which you can go into and understand it directly. Now, science education is slightly different when you get into it. So science education is about actually imparting to students, individuals, the ability to make scientific judgments or function scientifically. So rather than actually transfer knowledge into this large abstract thing called science, we are selecting science and transferring it into people. That's a sort of a fundamental aspect of it. And we can judge how well we've done it and the process in which that is done. The important thing is that people tend to import what they need or what they believe, and you have to carefully take things out of their suitcase of understanding to place things in. So a lot of people think, well, I'll just shout at a kid and convince him that the Earth is rotating around or orbiting the sun, not the sun is moving, and you can do that and they can produce it. But if they have that fundamental belief in there earlier and that they've grown up with it, it's hard to remove it. So there's that process, whereas science is putting an experience on a record, a universal record which is accessible. The actual teaching is the other way around. We're actually taking science and actually putting it into individuals. The other aspect is that where science doesn't really make too much of a judgment of who says something, as long as they say something and they can prove it scientifically, they're in. In theory, that's the way. Education goes the opposite way. It ascribes a value, a future value of this person. So you apply, you give them, you stock them up with scientific knowledge and skill for their future. And you also say, well, for your future, you can also have this badge, this qualification which goes with you, which is, indicates your suitability for future employers. Now, the validity of that is variable and employers are looking differently, but that's the idea of education. So education is actually not interacting with science the way scientists do. Scientists see it as a sort of a club where you have a protocol and methods of acting and candor and fair critique. A critique of an idea is not necessarily a critique of a person. Now, education is very much different in terms of a fact is a fact that's taught. And a lot of these facts are sort of scientifically untrue, but there's a consensus that this should be taught and this is suitable for the purposes of loading up a student with information and assessing them and describing it. So the fact is fit for the purpose, whether it is right or wrong. And you can see that this would conflict. So science would say, well, I can only move the fact forward if I know it's right and it's valid and it fits in with the whole quality control of science. That quality control isn't when you're moving facts in an opposite direction for reasons that would not quite make sense to science. Now we've got the idea of how people can form an opinion which is not supported by science. And this is sort of a process a behaviour of a fact which is not perfectly correct. We ascribe it to be, we take it as correct in the context. It doesn't make sense. But in order to do that, you have to basically follow a rule. So basically, when a science teacher acts as scientifically as the properties of an agent. So they have certain stimuli, they process those stimuli, and they have a response. So the stimuli that they receive and they process gives them a response of sometimes, quite a lot of the time, teaching scientifically incorrect information. And this is sort of a fundamental idea of a flock agent. So they are as an agent and they respond to stimuli in a certain way. And because they're looking at certain level of stimuli, not whether the scientific response, but whether it's acceptable to society, they come as a certain idea. So this is very much like a flock behaviour of agents. And I'd like to actually go through a flock behaviour of ducks. So ducks are in their in the summer of their hemisphere. In the summer of the hemisphere, and the days are getting shorter. The food, which was young and fresh from spring, the growth of spring is beginning to diminish a little bit. Lots of little signs around it. And so they don't make an individual decision, but they start to communicate their decision to other ducks. And so the other ducks will start to listen to the ducks. The quacking changes and the behavioural changes differently. And then en masse, they'll make a large-scale decision because they can't actually make the decision themselves. A large decision and actually en masse move and flick it to this migration pattern. So a similar sort of thing. This is the similar idea of agents. Agents in a market will do very much a similar type of thing. They'll sense a mood and then everyone will sell or then everyone will buy. And they'll do it partly because of the same factors, but there's this sort of feedback mechanism. And now this is because the actual processes are limited, that they rely on the crowd intelligence and crowd bulk decisions. And this can actually work quite well when there's no analysis, central analysis that is possibly available to the individual. Now, of course, that's the entire idea of science, is to make such analysis available to the individual. So your scientific duck is actually not going to listen to the quacks so much and be looking at other factors, maybe looking at weather patterns and doing its own calculations. But whereas the other ducks in the area will be listening to the other ducks. Now, this so too happens for teachers. They will look at what's taught in a textbook, what they were taught, and what other teachers are teaching. And if they teach the correct thing and no one marks it, no one else teaches it, that student will not pick up a mark. So they use sort of a peer assessment process to go through. Similarly, whereas a narrative is just one of the armament in the development of science, so you've got the science information and you actually build up a series of scenarios that a scientist can look at and build up overarching patterns. That's in science. In teaching, you tend to have a huge focus on the science and teach one pattern at a time, you train up your students as agents. That is, that they see a stimulus, do a prescribed processing of thought, and produce a response, and you have a feedback mechanism so that they can adjust their processes. This is very low-level stuff, and you look around and you decide what you're going to teach. You actually don't relate it to science. It's actually, you've actually removed it from science rather than saying, well, this fact, is it scientifically correct? So, say a common example that I've come across is the belief that just underneath the crust, the mantle of the earth is liquid. There's a belief that this is so because if you puncture the crust and make a volcano, liquid lava comes up. So it's basically say if you were to dig a hole and water would gush up, you could easily assume that there's water underneath the earth, but it's not just the fact that you've hit a bore and it's a hole. So what in actual fact scientifically happens is it's not liquid, it's more like plasticine. And under the pressure and under certain chemicals together, the actual temperature at which things melt reduce, and that tends to dissolve more flux. This is things which reduce the temperature of rocks. Again, you can have a temperature source and a liquid conducting the temperature far more effectively through convection. You can actually get a whole series of processes to create a local area of liquid, which is your magma chamber. The rest of the area outside the chamber is solid. And this seems really obvious when you look at it, but a lot of teachers just teach that the underneath the continents are floating on liquid magma, and they confirm, they would teach you that the actual mantle is a magma. This is all wrong, but the way they judge on that teaching is actually not go to the science and subject their concept to scientific scrutiny and read and actually travel through science and pick up information this way. They will instead say, well, what was I taught? What's written in the textbook? What does everyone around me? This is the surrounding quacks. And so as an agent, they will themselves operate at this agent level, pick up stimuluses, apply a rule, an effective rule of I have only a limited amount of time to process this, I have other things to do, that is transfer the information to the student and put a label onto the student. So I won't go ahead there. And so you have these things that, you know, what people are teaching, they're teaching basically downloading a version of science to the students which is compatible with teaching. It's like the circular argument. To fit in, people are beginning to look at facts which fit in with the teaching universe. And of course, as science improves year after year, that teaching universe becomes less and less relevant. You're looking in and you're saying, oh, well, look, some of the processes that they teach actually doesn't really grip with science. One of the processes that they teach is the scientific method. That is, you know, you come up with a hypothesis, you prove it, disprove it. That is sort of like sticking a pin into a map and seeing whether it's true or false. And if it's false, you say, well, that hypothesis is no good, I'll stick in another one and somehow get the hypothesis. And now this goes very well. You say that scientists do this, and I can tell you as a practicing scientist, that's just really one tiny aspect of how you would operate. You wouldn't actually operate with a hypothesis. I suppose one of the things that I suppose upset me is that people teaching hypothesis is that you've got to write the hypothesis, and to interpret what that hypothesis really means that educationally, you want to give the scientific reasoning for the hypothesis. And this really undermines the whole thing. So if a student sees a correct experiment result, they therefore say, well, my scientific reasoning is correct for it. So if they say water will not go above 100 degrees C because, I don't know, for some crazy reason that they think that, you know, water breaks apart after that, or water just breaks into hydrogen and oxygen at that point. That's where it decomposes, so you can't go above that thing because the water just disappears. And that's why it won't go above 100 degrees. Then they measure it, they go back and think, well, my faulty reasoning must be correct if they get a correct experimental result. So there's real dangers in that. It's not really used. But you bind that into a narrative, selective narrative, where you describe scientists behaving in a way which is consistent with your education theory. Amongst other things, the next generation of teachers who teach exactly the same way. So if you can imagine science lumbering along trying to build a very useful social engine, which has got quality control, full explanation bank, almost anything you can ask for, science will generate it to help you solve a problem. It's a solution offering. It's like it's like the biggest app that we can think of is really science itself, if you can think of it as an app, a solution offering. So you can see that, you can see that science education is going off in a different direction. That is, it's got the aim, quite frankly, of self-replicating, getting a certain amount of information across from a book into a student and signing it off, and assessing the students. So they've got that other aim, which is actually moving slightly in a different direction. And partly moving that different direction, they have this view of teaching science. And at one stage, I think people did actually go down the path of just testing hypotheses and doing aim, result, etc. I don't think that they've used it for communication. I can see not many experiments historically conducted in this particular way. So we come across, well, if science is not doing it, what are they doing? And science, I think Einstein's a fairly good example to look at, because there is the classic way that teachers teach Einstein, that Einstein did this same thing. He worked by himself, he had this hypothesis process and thought experiments, really focusing on the little bit of Einstein which said, look, I'm going to try and communicate through this traditional method. But Einstein actually created a mini science universe. So he had three, this is the 1905, he had three papers, one on Brownian motion, this is the discovery of atoms, the photoelectric effect and special relativity. But if you read the papers, he gathered a whole lot of different papers together and created like a little review, a little world of science where you could see patterns through it. And he made intelligent bets or reasoning. So where we would say rules, this is right or wrong, he used that as a sort of a fulcrum, a point in which to reason, and he extracted reasonable explanations out of patterns before the full information had gone. So the early work was forming a pattern. He picked out what the likely answers were to consistent with that pattern, even though there were large gaps in it. So he got the photoelectric effect, trying to reason what he could do reasonably with the view of the classical electron. And just about a few years, 10 years later, the classical electron was dead. We had quantum mechanics replacing it. But the quantum mechanics became afterwards, and so if you put that in, it colours the pattern more directly. So he had this idea of really creating an app, so to speak, or a collection of research to make a sort of mini science science universe. And he was able to make some big breakthroughs there. And so it's really interesting that the way we teach it is we interpret science, the science of Einstein, as if it supports the way we teach. So it's sort of like conveniently representing it there, but it's a little bit further from the truth. The interesting thing is that when Einstein and I have to remember this Hungarian scientist came and wrote a joint letter to Roosevelt in 1939, Einstein said, look, and he's previously written that he sees a forest of solutions raining down, and then he winnows those out, he uses logic to winnow it out, which is very far from taking an individual hypothesis and going yes or no. Is sort of a massively parallel thing. He did the same thing with the atomic bomb project. If you read his letter, he says, look, there are multiple ways of going. We should do them all at once and work them and create agency. So he really, if you read it, he basically described his mind and converted his mind for a country to use, and this is, I suppose, a new interpretation of what's going on. But indeed, the US then proceeded down every track and cross-fertilized solutions and patterns which came out. So they went down the track of isolating uranium-235. That was the way, if they concentrated that enough, it was enough for them to make reactors to manufacture plutonium. So the uranium-235 was concentrated, and they looked at two ways of concentrating it. This was by the centrifuge effect and also by iron separation, ionizing all the uranium and actually picking it up. Now, that last method led to a lot of the US development into particle physics, but it's the centrifuge which gave them the uranium for the Hiroshima bomb, and the plutonium, which was made at Hanford reactor, bomb reactor, made heaps and heaps of plutonium. Now, it wasn't a straightforward story. The uranium bomb went down in Nagasaki with 64 kilograms. The plutonium bomb was a much more difficult one to get, because when they made the plutonium, one of the things, as you make plutonium, as you cook it more and more, you go from the base plutonium, ideal for bomb grade, you get super bomb grade plutonium, which basically melts down before it can explode, and so you have to actually be really cunning and slam it together by putting it in basically a balloon and reverse exploding, putting the explosion on the outside of the balloon and getting the balloon to implode. So the bomb dropped from Nagasaki is this much more, looks like a big party balloon, and it's large, fairly light, and the bomb drops and the balloon implodes and slams the plutonium together from all directions. 4π steradium comes in all directions. It's all let off at the same time and goes down. So the US, using Einstein's mind, which he basically gave to the United States, and they said, well, we now have the organizational ability to put tens of thousands of people working on the Manhattan Project. Now, the interesting thing is that the Hiroshima went 64 kilograms of uranium. With Nagasaki, it was 50% more powerful with only 6.4 kilograms of plutonium. Now, the plutonium was quite hot. But you can see that America didn't produce one bomb, but actually managed to produce two bombs and stitch together a whole series of solutions there. Now, I say this now because Einstein's view of patterns and pattern recognition, assembling ideas to make a pattern, was the ability, had this innate ability to then, if you actually laid it out, this pattern recognition together with organization, sort of national organizations, you could actually combine these two forces together to make big science. So the Manhattan and World War II was the birth of big science. And we go along, and sitting at the back of big science is pattern recognition and judging the significance of different patterns to guide yourself through. So this is the engine of big science and science that we live at today. It's behind what's it's going on in CERN. It's behind what's going in gravity waves. I'll just stop and quickly talk about gravity waves at the moment. So gravity waves is picking up the significance of radiation, of vibrations. Now, there is something which definitely picks up the significance of vibration. This is a spider feeling the vibrations on a web. It's got a paw, a leg on the web, and it detects vibrations. And from the vibrations, it can detect what are the significance of the vibrations, convert that into a meal, and decides what it will do, whether it will run away, the webs have been destroyed, or there is in fact a little insect and it's struggling, and now it's not escaped, it's actually losing a bit of power. I can go up to it and finish it off and eat it. Now, the gravity wave people have built these incredibly sensitive spider webs. But what they have done is the spider vibrations are incredibly, incredibly light. And what they've done is they've actually, as Einstein, created a sort of a mini world of science for him to work at in 1905. What they've done is actually recreated the universe many times over, with many, many different collisions, and so they can actually track down what they're looking for. So they've actually created a virtual world, a virtual pattern, and fed that in and looked at significance. So we've got this general idea that science education has gone off to the left-hand side, doing something a bit crazy, basically reproducing itself. So it's a very stable system. It's teaching science education, not necessarily science. It's teaching how to, if you study science at high school, you learn how to teach science at high school. It's not necessarily all that relevant afterwards. And then looking the way science is practiced, there's this entire thing of pattern recognition, looking at significance and getting the maximum number of questions and answers after. It's a slightly different process. And so I'll go here as I talk about the a process that I think which will work at school to activate people. And it starts off looking at a science methodology, not just as a method which works into science, but as an actual active machine, where you actually create a mini universe for you to discuss and work within. And so you start off with, I have this insect, which goes from the left, Q, four P's, P, 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 three S's, MCQ, a multiple choice, answers, and then further questions. If you draw this out and draw a few legs sticking off the S's, you'll make a little insect. And the idea of this is to actually, this is a pattern that you recognize. The pattern has significance. And so it's patterns and significance again. Now, you can start off with a generalized question, a different topic area, and you start assembling. And you start a general introduction. So you have your question, which you will get back to, a preamble, which is the first P, and you will discuss that about the direction that we're in, and you'll gather from the students the patterns, the which is corresponds to the hypothesis, which is a guess at a pattern. But in general, you're trying to build a library of all possible patterns, all your knowledge that you can go, and you decide that you're going to test one of those patterns, and you're going to decide how you're going to test it, and you're going to create a path from your pattern that you have built, a virtual pattern, to actual physical evidence, which is a picture. So you've got patterns, preamble, patterns, path, picture. And so the picture may be a graph, it may be a photograph, it may be experience, it may be any information which corresponds to results. But it's the results processed into a recognizable representation of the pattern. So you may describe for boiling water, water reaches a certain, increases in temperature but stops at 100 degrees, and so you can make that pattern by making a graph. So I make a picture of that by making a graph. So you've got the Q's, the P's. You might now start to ask another, the side of the question is, you have to then peel away the significance of it. Now, significance really is gets towards discussion, reliability, and validity. But for reliability, you question the numerical significance of it. So, reliable, it's reliable if it can be repeated many times. It's reliable for whether the instruments are calibrated correctly. It's basically how repeatable it is. So is your picture a representative picture, or is it just a picture of your thumb, so to speak, or is it blurred, or each time you take a photograph it looks completely different? Then the next level of significance is the evidential significance, which corresponds to validity. And that is, it corresponds to validity, but it's what you can reasonably infer from that piece of information. What is this evidence of? And so, quite frankly, when you actually do a boiling of water, it is consistent with the evidence, consistent with this model. It's evidence that the particle modelers are not wrong. It's quite interesting. And then there's another level of significance again, which is the significance of why you're doing the experiment. Now, this may be news for you, so it's got a personal significance, or it may be important for its application to society, or it may have an application something to the sum total of science. We then, at this stage, come to the multiple choice question, which is where we create what we think the answer is and some likely alternatives, which is a polite way of saying, well, what misconceptions did you have before you came into this, that they would be the A, B, C, or D, the other wrong answers, what could be a likely wrong answer. Now, this is a very good educational link, and it sort of really links us back to the education space. So there's several ways it links into the education space. And having precisely that, we can now in a position to actually say what the answer is. And so from your body of patterns, your universe of patterns that you've got, you can actually create many questions and answers from that group of patterns, and your significance will guide you to the most effective answer and the most effective question. It's the question and answer come much later in your process, and the significance, it can be your own personal significance, and your contribution can be at your entry level. So if people know a lot, they can actually produce a much higher sophisticated level and produce this experience. The experimental experience can be much much more attuned to the actual educational level of the people going in. And they are actually producing basically a quality science paper out of it. So the end result is not a scientific report. It's actually getting much closer to a science paper, which contains all this reference to other interpretations, other information, and the understanding at this time. So we've got Q, four P's, three S's, a multiple choice question, an answer. And what we need to do that, once we've got the answer, we then have to say, well, these are the flow-on questions from it. Does this apply in all situations, or is there some way this is not correct, or what can we do further? So we can actually discuss it. So we've actually created a scientific paper, and you have the ability to assign a whole lot of people to contribute what their pattern is, get a whole lot of different levels of significance, and a whole teaching environment which actually produces something which is quite valuable. And these I call them QP forms, for question, preamble, blah, 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 forms. These shapes are really mini publications, and as such can actually be published to a web, be evaluated, awarded, and give back to the students a credit, a kudos, a value. And so in essence, it's not necessarily against education. It does achieve what's required, but it's a much more personally tuned or group tuned way of doing it. We have actually achieved the transfer of information and meaning into a student, and by recording it and say publishing it or putting it in a competition, it can have additional significance. But we can also make it as a publication, as we do, is award, use a scientific method of attributing, ascribing value to an individual by publication. Not by external exam, but by individual publication. So a student may have a poorly equipped lab or things like that. They can still perform as well because we're looking at their own progress. So that's my overview of having done science, seeing how science is a valuable app and offering. So science is happening, this idea of patterning and bundling ideas and stories together and data and programs together as an idea offering, is true what Einstein has done. It is true in the big science. It's also true in your idea of buying apps and downloading apps. It's an idea offering for you to use. And also it can actually be bundled and reused and reformed in the classroom. Now, the entire thing here is that you've gone out and you haven't actually used the duck version, the teacher version of, will I teach this? Well, because my other teacher has done it, it's actually moved beyond that. And of course, science is, the entire idea of science is to move society beyond people working out what to do because of their local community approving of it, and actually relying on a bigger world of science. And so it's actually, that's the real essence of science. It's actually moving beyond that peer-to-peer stimulus response via rules and deciding I'll do this, but to think of create a science universe and that you work in, a science zone that you work in, and rather than rules, these are thresholds or lines or things that you can say if this is true or if this is not true. What are the two consequences? What does the data show to me? So in a real sense, the teaching of students to recite scientific facts or produce test results indeed puts them up to the grade of an agent, but what happens with all equipment which becomes out of date, they become very quickly out of date or not used or not fit for purpose. And really, we want to train students to be members of a scientific community, and there is a way of doing that the way that scientists do it. And so really all I've done is looked at Einstein, looked at big science, looked at my own scientific career, and say, and worked backwards and reverse engineered that into the classroom and added a few ideas of teaching, and morphed a few ideas across this, particularly the multiple choice question, which addresses the area of preconceptions, and allows the preconceptions, rather than be laboured first and disproved, you can carry them on and you can say, aha, that preconception, oh, that's not the way to do it. It also rewards the structured observation of learning outcomes, the research that we have, that students don't necessarily hit the A-grade science, which produces a mark first off. They have methods before where they get one observation, a second observation, and put those two things together to get some sort of process, and then they add science to it. And in that pattern to path to picture sequence, that can be actually developed. So there's a whole lot of scientific understanding which has been shoved to the side because it's not useful in this textbook transfer into kids' heads process, but we can pick up by this new method of teaching. So that's all I have to say for tonight, and I'll send this off to you in podcast land and to other researchers, and eventually get hopefully a slick paper out. And just a final point. There's a different game in town. If you consider science teaching or the science community as a social mesh or a flock which changes behaviour all of a sudden. So in general, if you look at all science communities, there are around 200 science communities globally, and they have a method, a mesh method of teaching, which is by their curriculum, and their curriculum lasts roughly 20 years. So there's a new curriculum occurring somewhere on the planet every couple of months as coming through. So that curriculum really says there's a predominant method of teaching and everyone has to teach by it. So the aim of this is to pick up one or two lead schools, and to actually develop this scientifically. This is a scientific idea, a scientific methodology of teaching. It may or may not work, but let's report it and actually approach it scientifically. And you try and isolate it from the system. Trying to fuse it with the mesh system, which flocks to one way or another. That's not it. I think this can really work with the existing system, which is textbook transfer grade process. At the end of the day, that's what we want to do. I think this can exist as experimental patterns, and I'd really like to see it tried out in a few primary schools. It's ideal for the primary. The idea is that you can teach it in primary school, and this same model can actually track, because it's actually if you teach in primary school the way that big science does it, or the way that Einstein thought, why would you expect that it wouldn't be useful all the way through? It's sort of a very robust technique which can be taught at a very gentle level and to a more intense level. What I'm saying is that the actual model of diffusion model is in education, it is a lottery and then top down if it actually meets these political requirements of transferability and teachability, or teachability. and then it comes through, rather than universal diffusion. I really liked this attempt as a scientific experiment where certain labs around the world who have the ability to implement this sort of idea can do it and publish and create a body of knowledge. And as in science, things can be on the periphery, and with sufficient linkages, things on the periphery can come across. It's a different system from an ecosystem of practice of science. This is science education. Science has the ability to move ideas or transfer ideas very quickly and very subtly. So you can experiment on a long odds idea and gradually build it across with linking experiments. So I can see that this innovation linked to other innovations can suddenly or can move in and produce a very thorough, robust solution. So that's all I have to say tonight. Thanks for listening, and in the meantime, keep on doing science.